Highways, farms, and housing developments have destroyed most of them. And scientists have investigated only a small fraction of the survivors. Most of the earthworks were shaped like big cones and stepped pyramids, but some were sculpted into enormous birds, lizards, bears, long-tailed alligators, and, in Peebles, Ohio, a 1,330-foot-long serpent. The earliest known examples appeared in northeastern Louisiana about 5,400 years ago, well before the advent of agriculture. For reasons unknown, Indians heaved up a ring of 11 irregularly sized mounds, most of them connected by a ridge, on a hill overlooking the course of the Washita River. The biggest was as tall as a two-story house. About a dozen similar sites are known, of which the Washita Ring is the oldest and biggest. None of the mounds in any of these places cover burials or contain artifacts or show signs of use. Indeed, they seem to have so little purpose that archaeologist Joe Saunders of Northeast Louisiana University, whose team excavated the Washita Mounds in 1997, half-jokingly speculated to Science that the motive for building them could have been the act of construction itself. "I know it sounds awfully Zen-like," he conceded. Because modern-day hunter-gatherers in Africa live in egalitarian bands that constantly move from place to place, archaeologists assumed that Native American hunter-gatherers must also have done so. Discovering the Louisiana mounds upset this view. They suggest that at least some early Indians were stay-at-homes. More important, they testify to levels of public authority and civic organization rarely associated with nomads. Building a ring of mounds with baskets or deer skins full of dirt is a long-term enterprise. During construction, the workers must eat, which in turn means that other people must provide their food. Such levels of planning are ordinarily thought to kick in with the transition to agriculture. When people till and sow the land, anthropologists say, they set up systems to protect their investment. Eventually, somebody ends up in charge of allocating goods and services. But the mound builders in Louisiana built these massive constructions at a time when agriculture was barely underway. It was like the whiff in the air from a faraway ocean. In the central river valleys of North America, people had a way of life without known analog. After these first mounds, the record is sparse. After the Washita mounds, there is a gap in the record of more than a millennium. The curtain parts again in about 1500 BC, when an archipelago of villages, the largest known as Poverty Point, grew up in the northeast corner of Louisiana. Located 55 miles from the Washita site, Poverty Point had as a focus a structure resembling an amphitheater. Six concentric C-shaped ridges, each 5 feet tall, on a bluff facing the river. The jaws of the widest C are 3,950 feet apart, an expanse so big that scientists did not recognize the ridges as constructions until they took aerial photographs of the site in the 1950s. Now another gap, 700 years. The next major sequence occurs mainly in the Ohio Valley, hundreds of miles north. Here was a group known as the Edina. The name is that of a well-known site. Because Edina mounds served as tombs, researchers know more about their deaths than their lives. Accompanying the noble few in the tombs to the world of the deceased were copper beads and bracelets, stone tablets and collars, textiles and awls, and sometimes stone pipes in the shape of surreal animals. The head of the creature faced the user, who sucked in tobacco smoke from its mouth. Edina tobacco, a different species from the tobacco and cigarettes today, contains several hallucinogens and 5 to 10 times as much nicotine. Enough, all told, to make it psychoactive. Tobacco was only one of the crops grown at Edina villages. The Mississippi and Ohio valleys and much of the U.S. Southeast were home to what is known as the Eastern Agricultural Complex. A full-fledged agricultural revolution with a multifarious suite of crops. The complex is an example of a major cultural innovation that has completely disappeared. Its crops were such unfamiliar plants as marsh elder, knotweed, maygrass, and little barley. All of these species still exist. One could stock a specialty restaurant with them. Sample menu, maygrass patties, steamed knotweed beans, and buffalo tongue. No one seems to be doing that, though. In fact, farmers today treat several of these crops as weeds. They routinely blast little barley with herbicides. Archaeologists have tentative indications of early domestication in spots from Illinois to Alabama by 1000 BC. But agriculture did not begin to flower, so to speak, until the Edina. Edina influence in customs and artifacts can be spotted in archaeological sites from Indiana to Kentucky, and all the way north to Vermont and even New Brunswick. For a long time, researchers believe this indicated that the Edina had conquered other groups throughout this area, but many now believe that the influence was cultural. Like European teenagers donning baggy pants and listening to hip-hop, Edina's neighbors adopted its customs. Archaeologists sometimes call the area in which such cultural flows occur an interaction sphere. Both less and more than a nation. An interaction sphere is a region in which one society disseminates its symbols, values, and inventions to others. An example is medieval Europe, much of which fell under the sway of Gothic aesthetics and ideas. The Edina interaction sphere lasted from about 800 BC to about 100 BC. Textbooks sometimes say that the Edina were succeeded by the Hopewell, but the relation is unclear. The Hopewell may simply have been a later stage of the same culture. The Hopewell, too, built mounds, and like the Edina, seemed to have spoken an Algonquian language. Hopewell refers to the farmer on whose property an early site was discovered. Based in southern Ohio, the Hopewell interaction sphere lasted until about 400 AD, and extended across two-thirds of what is now the United States. Into the Midwest came seashells from the Gulf of Mexico, silver from Ontario, fossil shark's teeth from Chesapeake Bay, and obsidian from Yellowstone. In return, the Hopewell exported ideas, the bow and arrow, monumental earthworks, fired pottery. Edina pots were not put into kilns. And probably most important, the Hopewell religion. The Hopewell apparently sought spiritual ecstasy by putting themselves into trances, perhaps aided by tobacco. In this enraptured state, the soul journeys to other worlds. As is usually the case, people with special abilities emerged to assist travelers through the portal to the numinous. Over time, these shamans became gatekeepers, controlling access to the supernatural realm. They passed on their control and privileges to their children, creating a hereditary priesthood, counselors to kings, if not kings themselves. They acquired healing lore, mastered and invented ceremonies, learned the numerous divinities in the Hopewell pantheon. We know little of these gods today because few of their images have endured to the present. Presumably, shamans recounted their stories to attentive crowds. Almost certainly, they explained when and where the gods wanted to build mounds. In the context of the village, the mound, visible everywhere, was as much a beacon as a medieval cathedral. As with Gothic churches, which had plazas for the outdoor performance of sacred mystery plays, the mounds had greens before them, ritual spaces for public use. Details of the performances are lost, but there is every indication that they were exuberant affairs. There is a stunning vigor about the Ohio Hopewell, Silverberg wrote, a flamboyance and fondness for excess that manifests itself not only in the intricate geometrical enclosures and the massive mounds, but in these gaudy displays of conspicuous consumption in the tombs. To envelop a corpse from head to feet in pearls, to weigh it down in many pounds of copper, to surround it with masterpieces of sculpture and pottery, and then to bury everything under tons of earth, This betokens a kind of cultural energy that numbs and awes those who follow after. Vibrant and elaborate, perhaps a little vulgar in its passion for display, Hopewell religion spread through most of the eastern United States in the first 4 centuries A.D. As with the expansion of Christianity, the new converts are unlikely to have understood the religion in the same way as its founders. Nonetheless, its impact was profound. In a mutated form, it may well have given impetus to the rise of Cahokia. The Rise and Fall of the American Bottom. Cahokia was one big piece in the mosaic of chiefdoms that covered the lower half of the Mississippi and the Southeast at the end of the first millennium A.D. Known collectively as Mississippian cultures, these societies arose several centuries after the decline of the Hopewell culture, and probably were its distant descendants. At any one time, a few larger polities dominated the dozens or scores of small chiefdoms. Cahokia, biggest of all, was preeminent from about 950 to about 1250 AD. It was an anomaly, the greatest city north of the Rio Grande. It was also the only city north of the Rio Grande. 5 times or more bigger than any other Mississippian polity, Cahokia's population of at least 15,000 made it comparable in size to London, but on a landmass without Paris, Cordoba, or Rome. I call Cahokia a city so as to have a stick to beat it with, but it was not a city in any modern sense. A city provides goods and services for its surrounding area, exchanging food from the countryside for the products of its sophisticated craftspeople. By definition, its inhabitants are urban. They aren't farmers. Cahokia, however, was a huge collection of farmers packed cheek by jowl. It had few specialized craft workers and no middle-class merchants. On reflection, Cahokia's dissimilarity to other cities is not surprising. Having never seen a city, its citizens had to invent every aspect of urban life for themselves. Despite the 19th century fascination with the mounds, archaeologists did not begin to examine Cahokia thoroughly until the 1960s. Since then, studies have gushed from the presses. By and large, they have only confirmed Cahokia's status as a statistical outlier. Cahokia sat on the eastern side of the American bottom. Most of the area has clayey soil that is hard to till and prone to floods. Cahokia was located next to the largest stretch of good farmland in the entire American bottom. At its far edge, a forest of oak and hickory topped a line of bluffs. The area was little settled until as late as 600 AD, when people trickled in and formed small villages. Groups of a few hundred who planted gardens and boated up and down the Mississippi to other villages. As the millennium approached, the American bottom had a resident population of several thousand. Then, without much apparent warning, there was, according to the archaeologist Timothy R. Pocktat of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, what has been called a Big Bang, a few decades of tumultuous change. Cahokia's mounds emerged from the Big Bang, along with the East St. Louis Mound Complex a mile away, the second biggest after Cahokia, though now mostly destroyed, and the St. Louis Mounds just across the Mississippi, the fourth biggest. Monk's Mound was the first and most grandiose of the construction projects. Its core is a slab of clay about 900 feet long, 650 feet wide, and more than 20 feet tall. From an engineering standpoint, clay should never be selected as the bearing material for a big earthen monument. Clay readily absorbs water, expanding as it does. The American bottom clay, known as smectite clay, is especially prone to swelling. Its volume can increase by a factor of 8. Drying, it shrinks back to its original dimensions. Over time, the heaving will destroy whatever is built on top of it. The Cahokians' solution to this problem was discovered mainly by Woods, the University of Kansas archaeologist and geographer who has spent two decades excavating Monk's Mound. To minimize instability, he told me, the Cahokians kept the slab at a constant moisture level. Wet, but not too wet. Moistening the clay was easy. Capillary action will draw up water from the floodplain, which has a high water table. The trick is to stop evaporation from drying out the top. In an impressive display of engineering savvy, the Cahokians encapsulated the slab, sealing it off from the air by wrapping it in thin, alternating layers of sand and clay. The sand acts as a shield for the slab. Water rises through the clay to meet it, but cannot proceed further because the sand is too loose for further capillary action. Nor can the water evaporate. The clay layers atop the sand press down and prevent air from coming in. In addition, the sand lets rainfall drain away from the mound, preventing it from swelling too much. The final result covered almost 15 acres and was the largest earthen structure in the Western Hemisphere. Though built out of unsuitable material in a floodplain, it has stood for 1,000 years. Because the slab had to stay moist, it must have been built and covered quickly, a task requiring a big workforce. Evidence suggests that people moved from miles around to the American bottom to be part of the project. If the ideas of Pakhtet, the University of Illinois archaeologist, are correct, the immigrants probably came to regret their decision to move. To his way of thinking, the Big Bang occurred after a single ambitious person seized power, perhaps in a coup. Although his reign may have begun idealistically, Cahokia quickly became an autocracy. In an Ozymandiac extension of his ego, the supreme leader set in motion the construction projects. Loyalists forced immigrants to join the labor squads, maintaining control with the occasional massacre. Burials show the growing power of the elite. In a small mound half a mile south of Monk's Mound, archaeologists in the late 1960s uncovered six high-status people interred with shell beads, copper ornaments, mica artworks, and the sacrificed bodies of more than 100 retainers. Among them were 50 young women who had been buried alive. Woods disagrees with what he calls the proto-Stalinist work camp scenario. Nobody was forced to erect Monk's Mound, he says. Despite the intermittent displays of coercion, he says, Cahokians put it up because they wanted to. They were proud to be part of these symbols of community identity. Monk's Mound and its fellows were, in part, a shout-out to the world. Look at us! We're doing something different! It was also the construction of a landscape of sacred power, built in an atmosphere of ecstatic religious celebration. The American bottom, in this scenario, was the site of one of the world's most spectacular tent revivals. Equally important, Wood says, the Mound City was in large part an outgrowth of the community's previous adoption of maize. Before Cahokia's rise, people were slowly hunting the local deer and bison populations to extinction. The crops in the eastern agricultural complex could not readily make up the difference. Among other problems, most had small seeds. Imagine trying to feed a family on sesame seeds, and you have some idea of what it would have been like to subsist on maygrass. Maize had been available since the 1st century BC. It would have arrived sooner, but Indians had to breed land races that could tolerate the cooler weather, shorter growing seasons, and longer summer days of the north. The Hopewell, however, almost ignored it. Somewhere around 800 AD, their hungry successors took another look at the crop and liked what they saw. The American bottom, with its plentitude of easily cleared, maize-suitable land, was one of the best places to grow it for a considerable distance. The newcomers needed to store their harvests for the winter, a task most efficiently accomplished with a communal granary. The granary needed to be supervised, an invitation to develop centralized power. Growth happened fast and may well have been hurried along by a charismatic leader, Wood said. But something like Cahokia probably would have happened anyway. Maize also played a role in the city's disintegration. Cahokia represented the first time Indians north of the Rio Grande had tried to feed and shelter 15,000 people in one place. And they made beginner's mistakes. To obtain fuel and construction material, and to grow food, they cleared trees and vegetation from the bluffs to the east and planted every inch of arable land. Because the city's numbers kept increasing, the forest could not return. Instead, people kept moving further out to get timber, which then had to be carried considerable distances. Having no beasts of burden, the Cahokians themselves had to do all the carrying. Meanwhile, Woods told me, the city began outstripping its water supply, a somewhat wimpy tributary called Canteen Creek. To solve both of these problems at once, the Cahokians apparently changed its course, which had consequences that they cannot have anticipated. Nowadays, Cahokia Creek, which flows from the north, and Canteen Creek, which flows from the east, join together at a point about a quarter mile northeast of Monk's Mound. On its way to the Mississippi, the combined river then wanders, quite conveniently, within 200 yards of the central plaza. Originally, though, the smaller Canteen Creek alone occupied that channel. Cahokia Creek drained into a lake to the northwest, then went straight to the Mississippi, bypassing Cahokia altogether. Sometime between 1100 and 1200 AD, according to Woods's as-yet-unpublished research, Cahokia Creek split in two. One fork continued as before, but the second, larger fork dumped into Canteen Creek. The combined river provided much more water to the city. It was about 70 feet wide. And it also let woodcutters upstream send logs almost to Monk's Mound. A natural inference, to Woods's way of thinking, is that the city, in a major public works project, intentionally diverted Cahokia Creek. In summer, heavy rains lashed the Mississippi Valley. With the tree cover stripped from the uplands, rainfall would have sluiced faster and heavier into the creeks, increasing the chance of floods and mudslides. Because the now combined Cahokia and Canteen Creeks carried much more water than had Canteen Creek alone, washouts would have spread more widely across the American bottom than would have been the case if the rivers had been left alone. Beginning in about 1200 AD, according to Woods, Cahokia's maize fields repeatedly flooded, destroying the harvests. The city's problems were not unique. Cahokia's rise coincided with the spread of maize throughout the eastern half of the United States. The Indians who adopted it were setting aside millennia of tradition in favor of a new technology. In the past, they had shaped the landscape mainly with fire. The axe came out only for garden plots of marsh elder and little barley. As maize swept in, Indians burned and cleared thousands of acres of land, mainly in river valleys. As in Cahokia, floods and mudslides rewarded them. How do archaeologists know this? They know it from sudden increases in river sedimentation. One 2011 study estimated the onset of maize agriculture increased surface runoff in the Delaware River Valley by 50%, coupled with the near disappearance of pollen from bottomland trees in those sediments. Between about 1100 and 1300 AD, cataclysms afflicted Indian settlements from the Hudson Valley to Florida. Apparently, the majority learned from mistakes. After this time, archaeologists don't see this kind of widespread erosion, though they do see lots and lots of maize. A traveler in 1669 reported that 6 square miles of maize typically encircled Haudenosaunee villages. This estimate was very roughly corroborated 2 decades later by the Marquis de Denonville, governor of New France, who destroyed the annual harvest of 4 adjacent Haudenosaunee villages to deter future attacks. Denonville reported that he had burned 1.2 million bushels of maize, 42,000 tons. Today, as I mentioned in Chapter 6, Oaxacan farmers typically plant roughly 1.25 to 2.5 acres to harvest a ton of landrace maize. If that relation held true in upstate New York, a big, but not ridiculous assumption, Arithmetic suggests that the four villages, closely packed together, were surrounded by between 8 and 16 square miles of maize fields. Between these fields was the forest, which Indians were subjecting to parallel changes. Sometime in the first millennium AD, the Indians who had burned undergrowth to facilitate grazing began systematically replanting large belts of woodland, transforming them into orchards for fruit and mast. The general name for hickory nuts, beech nuts, acorns, butternuts, hazelnuts, pecans, walnuts, and chestnuts. Chestnut was especially popular. Not the imported European chestnut roasted on Manhattan street corners in the fall, but the smaller, soft-shelled, deeply sweet Native American chestnut, now almost extinguished by chestnut blight. In colonial times, as many as one out of every four trees in between southeastern Canada and Georgia was a chestnut, partly the result, it would seem, of Indian burning and planting. Hickory was another favorite. Rambling through the southeast in the 1770s, the naturalist William Bartram observed Creek families storing 100 bushels of hickory nuts at a time. They pound them to pieces and then cast them into boiling water, which, after passing through fine strainers, preserves the most oily part of the liquid. To make a thick milk, as sweet and rich as fresh cream, an ingredient in most of their cookery, especially hominy and corn cakes. Years ago, a friend and I were served hickory milk in rural Georgia by an eccentric backwoods artist named Saint Eom, who claimed Creek descent. Despite the unsanitary presentation, the milk was ambrosial, fragrantly nutty, delightfully heavy on the tongue, unlike anything I had encountered before. Within a few centuries, the Indians of the Eastern Forest reconfigured much of their landscape from a patchwork game park to a mix of farmland and orchards. Enough forest was left to allow for hunting, but agriculture was an increasing presence. The result was a new balance of nature. From today's perspective, the success of the transition is striking. It was so sweeping and ubiquitous that early European visitors marveled at the number of nut and fruit trees and the big clearings with only a dim apprehension that the two might be due to the same human source. One reason that Bartram failed to understand the artificiality of what he saw was that the surgery was almost without scars. The new landscape functioned smoothly, with few of the overreaches that plagued English land management. Few of the overreaches, but not none. Cahokia was a glaring exception. A friend and I first visited Cahokia in 2002. Woods, who lived nearby, kindly agreed to show us around. The site is now a state park with a small museum. From Monk's Mound, we walked halfway across the southern plaza and then stopped to look back. From the plaza, Woods pointed out, the priests at the summit could not be seen. There was smoke and noise and sacred activity constantly going on up there, but the peasants didn't know what they were doing. Nonetheless, average Cahokians understood the intent, to assure the city's continued support by celestial forces. And that justification fell apart with the floods, Woods said. There is little indication that the Cahokia floods killed anyone, or even led to widespread hunger. Nonetheless, the string of woes provoked a crisis of legitimacy. Unable to muster the commanding vitality of their predecessors, the priestly leadership responded ineffectively, even counterproductively. Even as the flooding increased, it directed the construction of a massive 2-mile-long palisade along the central monuments, complete with bastions, shielded entryways, and maybe a catwalk up top. The wall was built in such a brain-frenzied hurry that it cut right through some commoners' houses. Cahokia being the biggest city around, it seems unlikely that the palisade was needed to deter enemy attack. In the event, none materialized. Instead, it was probably created to separate elite from hoi polloi, with the goal of emphasizing the priestly ruler's separate, superior, socially critical connection to the divine. At the same time, the palisade was also intended to welcome the citizenry. Anyone could freely pass through its dozen or so wide gates. Constructed at enormous cost, this porous architectural folly consumed 20,000 trees. More consequential, the elite revamped Monk's Mound. By extending a low platform from one side, they created a stage for priests to perform ceremonies in full view of the public. According to Woods' acoustic simulations, every word should have been audible below, lifting the veil of secrecy. It was the Cahokian equivalent of the Reformation, except that the church imposed it on itself. At the same time, the nobles hedged their bets. Cahokia's rulers tried to bolster their position by building even bigger houses and flaunting even more luxury goods like fancy pottery and jewelry made from exotic semi-precious stones. It did no good. A catastrophic earthquake raised Cahokia in the beginning of the 13th century, knocking down the entire western side of Monk's Mound. In 1811 and 1812, the largest earthquakes in U.S. history abruptly lifted or lowered much of the central Mississippi Valley by as much as 12 feet. The Cahokia earthquake, caused by the same fault, was of similar magnitude. It must have splintered many of the city's wood and plaster buildings. Fallen torches and scattered cooking fires would have ignited the debris, burning down most surviving structures. Water from the rivers, shaken by the quake, would have sloshed onto the land in a mini tsunami. Already reeling from the floods, Cahokia never recovered from the earthquake. Its rulers rebuilt Monk's Mound, but the poorly engineered patch promptly sagged. Meanwhile, the social unrest turned violent. Many houses went up in flames. "There was a civil war," Wood said, "fighting in the streets. The whole polity turned in on itself and tore itself apart." For all their energy, Cahokia's rulers made a terrible mistake. They did not attempt to fix the problem directly. True, the task would not have been easy. Trees cannot be replaced with the snap of the fingers. Nor could Cahokia Creek readily be reinstalled in its original location. "Once the water starts flowing in the new channel," Woods said, "it is almost impossible to put it back in the old, as the new channel rapidly downcuts and establishes itself." Given Cahokia's engineering expertise, though, solutions were within reach. Terracing hillsides, diking rivers, even moving Cahokia. Like all too many dictators, Cahokia's rulers focused on maintaining their hold over the people, paying little attention to external reality. By 1350 AD, the city was almost empty. Never again would such a large Indian community exist north of Mexico. Hundred Years' War. In the early 1980s, I visited Chetumal, a coastal city on the Mexico-Belize border. A magazine had asked me to cover the intellectual ferment caused by the decipherment of Maya hieroglyphics. In researching the article, the photographer, Peter Menzel, and I became intrigued by the then little-known site of Calakmul, whose existence had been first reported 5 decades before. Although it was the biggest of all the Maya ruins, it had never felt an archaeologist's trowel. Its temples and villas, enveloped in thick tropical forest, were as close to a lost city as we would ever be likely to see. Before visiting Calakmul, though, Peter wanted to photograph it from the air. Chetumal had the nearest airport, which was why we went there. The town was unpromising in those days. We arrived late in the night, and the only restaurant we could find served a single platter: octopus with pureed beef liver. I am, as a rule, a member of the Clean Plate Club. Looking at the rubbery white octopus chunks bobbing in the tarry mass of liver, I rejected an entire meal for the first time since childhood. Soon afterward, the electricity went out everywhere in town. For that reason, we did not discover until we retired that our hotel beds were full of little hungry creatures. I was peevish the next morning when we met our pilot. At first, we flew over Highway 186, which arrows west from Chetumal across the Maya heartland. Every so often, the pilot tapped my shoulder and pointed to an anonymous, tree-covered hummock. "Ruinas," he said. Otherwise, there was little to report. After a while, we turned south, toward the border with Guatemala. The Yucatan Peninsula grows wetter as one heads south. The vegetation beneath the plain quickly became thicker, lusher, higher, more aggressive. All at once, we came upon Calakmul. The city proper, built on a low ridge, had once housed as many as 50,000 people and sprawled across an area as big as 25 square miles. The city-state's total population may have been 575,000. The downtown area alone had 6,000 masonry structures, homes, temples, palaces, and granaries. Even an 18-foot-high defensive wall. Scattered through the neighborhoods was a network of reservoirs, many apparently stocked with fish. Thousands of acres of farmland extended beyond. Little of this was known then. I am quoting from later reports, and none of it was visible from the plain. From our vantage, the only visual testament to Calakmul's past majesty was its two great central pyramids, each wrapped to the shoulders in vegetation. Peter asked the pilot to fly low circles around the pyramids while he put together the perfect match of light, lens, angle, and shutter speed. He swapped lenses and cameras and window views in a dozen different combinations. At a certain point, he asked, peering through the shutter, "¿Cuánta gasolina tenemos?" How much gas do we have? The pilot squinted at the fuel gauge, 3/4 full. A puzzled look spread over his face. I leaned over to watch as he tapped the gauge's foggy plastic cover with his forefinger. The needle plunged almost to empty. It had been pinned. Peter put down his cameras. Eventually, the blood returned to our heads, permitting cerebration. We had to decide whether to take the shortest path to the airport, straight across the forest, or turn to the north and then fly east along Highway 186, which we could try to land on if we ran out of gas. The trade-off was that the highway route was so much longer that choosing it would greatly increase our chances of a forced touchdown. Soon we realized the decision boiled down to one question. How scary was the prospect of landing in the forest? I recall looking down at the trees. They had engulfed the great buildings and were slowly ripping apart the soft limestone with their roots. Circling above the city, I had thought, nobody will ever find out anything about this place. The forest is too overpowering. Calakmul's inhabitants had cut a little divot into its flanks for their city. But now the vegetation, massive and indifferent, was smothering every trace of their existence. From the plain, the trees seemed to march to the horizon without interruption. We flew over the highway. I tried not to stare at the fuel gauge. Still, I couldn't help noticing as, one after another, warning lights blinked on. The plane had so little gas that the engine quit a moment after our wheels hit the tarmac. When we rolled silently to a stop, the pilot leapt out and kissed the ground. I sat back and regarded Chetumal with new affection. In the mid-1990s, the Mexican government paved a road to the site, which is now the center of the 1.7 million acre Calakmul Biosphere Reserve. Aerial views of the ruins are now spectacular. Archaeologists have cleared most of the central city. Along the way, contrary to my initial impression, they have managed to learn a great deal about Calakmul, the landscape it occupied, and the collapse that led to the forest's return. To begin with, they deciphered Calakmul's proper name, Khan, the Kingdom of the Snake. Impressively, they learned it from the best possible source, the ancient Maya themselves. Maya scribes wrote in codices made of folded fig bark paper, or deerskin. Unfortunately for posterity, the Spaniards destroyed all but 4 of these books. The rest of what remains are texts on monuments, murals, and pottery. About 15,000 samples of writing, according to one estimate. Piecing together events from these sources is like trying to understand the U.S. Civil War from the plaques on park statues. Possible, but tricky. Combining literal interpretation with an understanding of context, epigraphers, decipherers of ancient writing, have spent the last 30 years hauling submerged chunks of Maya history to the surface. David Stewart, a Mayanist at Harvard, decocted the encounter between Choctaw-Quechac and the Teotihuacan expedition in 2000. And Simon Martin and Nikolai Grube, respectively of University College London and the University of Bonn, first put the history of the great Mutal Khan War together in 1996. Most of the stelae at Khan were made from soft stone that has eroded too much to be readable. Martin and Grube thus had to rely on inscriptions at other sites that mention Khan and its rulers. These are surprisingly numerous. Too numerous, in a way. Archaeologists have turned up at least 11 versions of Khan's early dynastic history painted on big vases. Exasperatingly, none of the 11 tells exactly the same story. The chronological list of rulers differs on different lists. Some lists do not include known kings, and some include kings who probably were mythological. As if a tally of English rulers matter-of-factly included King Arthur and his father, Uther Pendragon. The dates are inconsistent, too. Khan's origins may reach back as far as 400 BC. But the city-state does not unambiguously enter the historical record until about 500 AD. When it had a king named Yuknom Chain, the city was already dominating its neighbors. In 546, Yuknom Chain's apparent successor supervised the coronation of a 5-year-old monarch in nearby Narinhoe. This supervision, recorded on a stela erected 70 years afterward, is the first known example in Yucatan of a Mesoamerican specialty, the chaperoned coronation. For much of the last century, most Mayanists believed that at its height, 200 to 900 AD, roughly speaking, the Maya realm was divided into a huggermugger of more or less equivalent city-states. Critics pointed out that this theory failed to account for an inconvenient fact. Khan, Mutal, and a few other cities were much bigger and more imposing than their neighbors, and therefore, one would usually assume, more powerful. According to the skeptics, Maya society was divided into a small number of blocks, each controlled by a dominant city, each striving to achieve some semblance of empire. Compelling evidence for this view did not emerge until the mid-1980s, when several epigraphers figured out that the Maya glyph, Ahau, which means sovereign or lord, had a possessive form, Yahau, his lord, meaning a lord who belongs to another lord. That is, a vassal king. Another glyph, Ukai, turned out to mean by the action of. They were only two words, but enough to make dozens of texts speak. In the stela, the 5-year-old Ahau in Narinhoe was crowned by the action of, the Ahau of Khan. Narinhoe's young king belonged to Khan. Narinhoe is the name scientists gave to the city. Its original name may have been Sol. The political landscape of the classic Maya resembles many in the old world. Classical Greece or Renaissance Italy are worthy comparisons, where a sophisticated and widely shared culture flourished among perpetual division and conflict. Martin and Gruba wrote in Chronicles of the Maya Kings and Queens, 2000, the remarkable summary of the epigraphic discoveries of the last three decades. It was a world crisscrossed by numerous patron-client relationships and family ties, in which major centers vied with one another in enmities that could endure for centuries. As Martin put it to me, Maya civilization indeed bore striking similarities to that of ancient Greece. The Greeks were divided into numerous fractious communities, some of which were able to dominate others by threats of force, unequal alliance, or commerce. And just as the conflicted relationship among Athens and Sparta was a leitmotif of Greek life, so Maya society resounded for centuries with the echoes of the struggle between Mutal and Khan. Sometime before 561 AD, a ruler known only as Sky Witness took the throne of Khan. A major figure despite his obscurity, Sky Witness set out to destroy Mutal. The motive for his hatred is uncertain, though it may have been rooted in the invasion from Teotihuacan. The new rulers of Mutal had aggressively thrown their weight around, and by Sky Witness's time, controlled as much as 8,000 square miles. Mutal city itself had an estimated population of 60,000, plus many more in its hinterland. Particularly important, the Teotihuacan-backed dynasty took over several outposts on the Usumacinta river system, Yucatan's most important trade route. Shipments of luxury goods from faraway regions usually had to travel up or down the Usumacinta. Mutal's ability to tax and supervise the trade must have been terribly vexing, even if it had little practical import. Sky Witness may have thought that Mutal was becoming a dangerous neighbor and decided to take preemptive action. Or he may have wanted to control the Usumacinta and its tributaries himself. A dynastic dispute may have been involved. Gruba told me that he thought the kings of Khan, never allied with Teotihuacan, may have wanted to stamp out pernicious foreign influences. Xenophobia is a powerful motive in every culture. No matter what the motive, Sky Witness's plan to dismantle Mutal was brilliant. In the short run, anyway. In the long run, it helped set in motion the Maya collapse. Khan and Mutal had a lot at stake. The Yucatan Peninsula is like a gigantic limestone wharf projecting into the Caribbean. Roughly speaking, the northwest-southeast line on which it joins the mainland runs through the middle of the Maya heartland. Despite receiving 3 to 5 feet of precipitation in an average year, this area is prone to drought. Almost all the rain falls during the May to December rainy season and rapidly sinks hundreds of feet into the porous limestone, from where it cannot easily be extracted. Little is available during the 5 hot, dry months between January and April. The region does have permanently water-filled swamps, sinkholes, and lakes, but often these are too salty to drink or use for irrigation. So toxic is the groundwater, a U.S.-Mexican research team remarked in 2002, that the Maya realm was geochemically hostile to urban colonization. Its occupation more resembled settlements on the moon or Antarctica than most other terrestrial habitats. Most of the salt occurred in the sediments on the swamp bottoms. To make the water potable, the Maya laid a layer of crushed limestone atop the sediments, effectively paving over the salt. As the researchers noted, the work had to be done before the Maya could move in and set up their milpas and gardens. Permanent year-round populations could be established only in the presence of an anticipatory engineering of water supplies. The Maya heartland, in other words, was a network of artificially habitable terrestrial islands. As Maya numbers grew, so did the islands beneath them. North of Khan, half a dozen small cities improved agricultural conditions by lifting up entire fields and carving out rain-retaining terraces on dry hillsides. Khan itself dug out a series of reservoirs, established neighborhoods around each one, and linked the ensemble with roads and waterways. Central Mutal was ringed by a chain of 7 reservoirs. With another central reservoir reserved for royalty, and so on. Revamping the landscape both allowed Maya cities to expand and made them more vulnerable. Despite constant maintenance, erosion silted up reservoirs, hurricanes destroyed terraces, and weeds and sediment choked irrigation networks. Over time, the Maya found themselves simultaneously maintaining existing systems and pushing out to cover past mistakes. If war damage made it impossible for a city's inhabitants to keep up, they would be in trouble. Island dwellers who wreck their homes have no place to move. One can speculate that the losers' fear of having their backs to the wall generated the extraordinary tenacity of the Khan-Muttal conflict. Sky Witness's strategy was to ring Muttal with a chain of client states and allies and then strangle it, boa constrictor style. In this way, Khan would both acquire a dominant position in the Maya realm and destroy its enemy. The first step was to suborn Muttal's most important vassal, the King of Oswiecza, now known as Karakol. With 115,000 people, Oswiecza was twice as populous as Muttal and controlled almost as much territory. Yet it had become Muttal's vassal soon after Teotihuacan installed the new dynasty. No concrete evidence exists that the first event caused the second, but the coincidence in timing is hard to dismiss. Sky Witness seems to have divined or inspired resentment in Oswiecza. The King of Oswiecza took the throne by the action of Muttal in 553 AD. Within 3 years, Sky Witness had persuaded the new ruler of Oswiecza to betray his masters. Maya polities were not large enough to maintain standing armies. Instead, both Khan and Oswiecza mustered short-term militiamen to fight wars. Wearing cotton armor and wooden helmets, brandishing lances, hatchets, and maces, and carrying great painted litters with effigies of their gods, the two militias marched on Muttal. Khan is some 60 miles north of Muttal. Oswiecza is 50 miles south of it. The two cities planned to crush Muttal between them. They carefully chose the day of the attack. Maya priests tracked the movements of Venus, which they regarded as a powerful portent. Its day of emergence in the morning sky was considered an occasion on which warfare and violence was likely to be rewarded. An optimal day to attack a city. On April 29, 562, in what archaeologists call a Star Wars assault, the two celestially guided armies overran Muttal, sacked its precincts, and probably killed its king. The relevant glyphs are too worn to read. Khan did not directly occupy Muttal. Victorious Maya cities rarely had the manpower to rule their rivals directly. Instead, in the by now familiar hegemonic pattern, they tried to force the rulers of the vanquished state to become their vassals. If an enemy sovereign was slain, as apparently happened in Muttal, the conquerors often didn't emplace a new one. Kings were divine, and thus by definition, irreplaceable. Instead, the victorious force simply quit the scene, hoping that any remaining problems would disappear in the ensuing chaos. This strategy was partly successful in Muttal. Not a single dated monument was erected in the city for a century. Because the city's post-attack rulers had, at best, distant connections to the slain legitimate king, they struggled for decades to get on their feet. Unhappily for Khan, they eventually did it. The agent for Muttal's return was its king, Nun-Uhol-Chok. Taking the helm of the city in 620 AD, he was as determined to re-establish his city's former glory as Khan's rulers were to prevent it. He suborned Khan's eastern neighbor, Narinho, which attacked Muttal's former ally, Oswiecza. The ensuing conflict spiraled out to involve the entire center of the Maya realm. Decades of conflict, including a long civil war in Muttal, led to the formation of two large blocks, one dominated by Muttal, the other by Khan. As cities within the blocks traded attacks with each other, half a dozen cities ended up in ruins, including Narinho, Oswiecza, Muttal, and Khan. The story was not revealed in full until 2001, when a storm uprooted a tree in the ruin of Dos Pilas, a Muttal outpost. In the hole from its root ball, archaeologists discovered a set of steps carved with the biography of Bahla Chan Kawil, a younger brother or half-brother to Muttal's dynasty-restoring king, Nun-Uhol-Chok. As deciphered by the epigrapher, Stanley Gunther, the staircase and associated monuments reveal the turbulent life of a great scalawag who spent his life alternately running from the armies of Khan and Muttal and trying to set them against each other. Born in 625, Bakhla Chan Kawil schemed for power from his base in Dos Pilas, setting off a civil war between forces loyal to him and those loyal to Nun Ucholchak. At the moment Tikal was divided, Khan conquered it, forcing both brothers to recognize the other city as their overlord. Bakhla Chan Kawil switched sides and became a loyal servant of Khan. Nun Ucholchak took the opposite course. He plotted revenge against Khan and his allies, his first step being to attack Dos Pilas in 1672, ejecting his mendacious brother. Having unified Tikal, he built up his forces for a long-delayed counterattack. Nun Ucholchak and his army met the forces of Khan on April 30, 679. Maya battles rarely involved massive direct engagements. This was an exception. In an unusual excursion into the high flown, the inscriptions on the stairway apostrophized the gore. The blood was pooled and the skulls of the Mutal people were piled into mountains. Bakhla Chan Kawil was carried by bearers into the fray in the guise of the god Iksip, a deity with a black painted face. In this way, he acquired its supernatural power. The technique worked, according to the stairway. In the midst of the battle, Bakhla Chan Kawil brought down the spears and shields of Nun Ucholchak. Having killed his brother, the treacherous Bakhla Chan Kawil took the throne of Mutal. In a celebration, Bakhla Chan Kawil joined the rulers of Khan in a joyous ceremonial dance on May 10, 682. But even as he danced with his master, a counter-revolutionary coup in Mutal placed Nun Ucholchak's son onto the throne, from where he quickly became a problem. On August 5, 695, Khan's soldiers once again went into battle against Mutal. Bright with banners, obsidian blades gleaming in the sun, the army advanced on the long-term enemy it had routed so many times before, and was utterly defeated. In a psychological blow, Mutal captured the effigy of a Khan patron deity, an enormous supernatural jaguar that its army carried into battle. A month later, in a mocking ceremonial pageant, the king of Mutal paraded around with the effigy strapped to the back of his palanquin. Khan's loss marks the onset of the Maya collapse. Khan never recovered from its defeat. Mutal lasted another century before it, too, sank into oblivion. Between 800 and 830 AD, most of the main dynasties fell. Cities winked out throughout the Maya heartland. Mutal's last carved inscription dates to 869. Soon after, its great public spaces were filled with squatters. In the next 100 years, the population of most southern areas declined by at least 3/4. The disaster was as much cultural as demographic. The Maya continued to exist by the million, but their central cities did not. Morley, the Harvard archaeologist, documented the cultural disintegration when he discovered that Maya inscriptions with long count dates rise steadily in number from the first known example, at Mutal in 292 AD, peak in about 790, and cease altogether in 909. The decline tracks the Maya priesthood's steady loss of the scientific expertise necessary to maintain its complex calendars. The fall has been laid at the door of overpopulation, overuse of natural resources, and drought. It is true that the Maya were numerous. Archaeologists agree that more people lived in the heartland in 800 AD than today. And the Maya indeed had stretched the meager productive capacity of their homeland. The evidence for drought is compelling, too. 4 independent lines of evidence: ethnohistoric data, correlations between Yucatan rainfall and measured temperatures in Western Europe, measurements of oxygen variants in lake sediments associated with drought, and studies of titanium levels in the Caribbean floor, which are linked to rainfall. indicate that the Maya heartland was hit by a severe drought at about the time of its collapse. Water levels receded so deeply, the archaeologist Richardson Gill argued in 2000, that starvation